Right now, we're going to talk about something that is probably top of mind for a lot of parents, teenage girls and social media. And I know someone here in the room who will have a teenager before she knows it.
I know, but about 3 years away for my oldest daughter. In the subject of social media and teens having access to phones and everything that comes with it is part of a New York Times article called Being 13, following the day-to-day lives of three young girls for 1 year as they navigate entering the world of social media. The article was written by Jessica Bennett. She joined us yesterday and began by asking how she was able to get three young girls to share all of their secrets on social media with a New York Times reporter and its readers, including audio recordings of themselves throughout the year.
Great question. A lot of cajoling and reminding. And sometimes we had to take breaks when they were grounded, which they all were at multiple points throughout the project. But Colleen, like you said, I mean, it's so tricky for parents because you don't want your kid to be totally left out of what's happening in the conversation or what the kids are talking about at school. And yet there are all of these things about having a phone that are just unhealthy.
Absolutely. Yeah. And for me, it's less, I want you to be able to fit in, and more a safety thing. We did get her one of those watches, but it, you know, it's completely locked down. It's basically a pedometer that she can text her dad and me on if something changes about the school pickup scenario. But for those peers of hers that have phones, when we try to hang out outside of school, and I've heard my daughter say this, they're just always on their phone. They're just always looking at their phone. I mean, you know, it bums them out, the ones that, because they're not making a connection anymore.
Yeah, I mean, it's tough. You know, we wanted to do this story because so many of the headlines these days are talking about, you know, potentially toxic effects of phone use and how it impacts self-esteem and all of these things. And, you know, what we really know when you dig into the data is that it's not totally clear how this is going to play out. We don't exactly know the effects of social media and phones on kids' brains, but we can make some assumptions. And yeah, if you're not engaging in real life and you're just on the phone all the time, that's going to affect all sorts of cognitive abilities and the way that you communicate and the way that you socialize. But we specifically wanted to focus on teen girls because we know that around this age in middle school, so these were 13-year-olds, is when girls' self-esteem tends to drop. And we've known since the pandemic that, you know, rates of anxiety and depression in girls have really gone up a lot. And so we were curious, how does that play when at 13 years old, you are, according to all of these social media sites, legally able to join? And what does that look like?
What did it look like? What did you find out from your subjects?
Well, you know, I think it's a mixed bag. Like, it's not all bad. There are communities that people find online. You know, I think back to being a 13-year-old and feeling really isolated and like a weirdo and not having like-minded people around me. And maybe there were some communities I could have found that might have helped me. But at the same time, I think you have to be really cautious about it. And so much of what these girls are going through is the same stuff that I think we all went through. You know, it's like hormones, puberty, friendships, like friendships are changing so fast, you can hardly keep up. Being on the in with friends, being on the outs, you know, drama at school, grades, stress, anxiety, like things that are not uncommon and are really normal. But then you have this threat of it being public at all times. So, you know, you make a small mistake or something silly happens at school, and normally that washes over you or it passes the next day. But now someone's recording it. And so what happens when, you know, your best moments or your worst moments or just moments in between are cemented in this much more permanent way that reaches the large audience? And I think in a lot of ways, it really changes behavior if in the back of your mind, you're thinking about having an audience at all times.
Yeah, which makes me wonder, well, I guess I understand why they get on in the first place, because everybody else is on and you got to be part of the crowd, get all the party invitations. But at least in a school setting, you will see these people face to face from time to time, right? So you can say, you know, wait a second, who do you think you are doing this to me? Can't you end it because you had that personal relationship?
Were you that confident at 13, Dave?
Well, I mean, we settled things a little differently, you know, on the playground. But I mean, there's still a form of that there. It's not people who are, you know, sitting in a bedroom somewhere in Bulgaria spreading misinformation about you. It's the person in the next seat. So can't you turn to that person and say, what's going on? How would you like it if I did this to you?
I mean, I think you can, but I think that's hard. I mean, that's hard for adults even. So I think that sometimes this stuff is playing out anonymously. Other times, you know, they're only having face-to-face conversations when it makes its way into the principal's office or the school counselor. And, you know, from an education standpoint too, this is challenging. Like, teachers, principals, administrators, you know, school phones are not allowed during class, of course, but there is every way ever to get around that. And the kids are more adept at technology than the adults. And so it's almost as if the school adults cannot keep up with the kids and the ways that they're getting around it. So I had a number of administrators joke to me at certain points, like, we really need like a team consultant on our staff to help us understand how they're using it, because it's being used in all these different ways. And the other thing too is, you know, not every girl in this story was allowed on social media. So there was one in particular who is not allowed on any social media. She has a phone, sort of like you described, calling to communicate with parents for school related things. But everyone else is on it. And so there was a whole drama that played out with her that was on social media, and she couldn't even know what was being said about her because she wasn't on the platform. So it's not as if just taking your kid's phone away is the simple answer.
That was Jessica Bennett. She's with the New York Times. We will dive a little deeper into this conversation with her in the next hour, including looking at how to navigate social media impacts and the way teens' brains are developing. I have to say, I passed her interactive article on to my husband and a number of parents as well that I know are struggling with this question. And it's a meaty article, right?
Yeah,
like,
it is.
Take multiple breaks as you do it. But so much, it's a wealth of information to help just give you some background and some help as you try to navigate what works for your family. Again, it's not a one size fits all, but in all of our conversations with smart people about the effects of phones and social media on brains, adults included, it sounds like we as adults need to step up and restrict it to withstand the social pressure to allow it in order to allow our children to develop as they should.
Yeah. I just hope that there is room for kids to talk to each other once this kind of thing breaks out one-on-one and say, okay, why is this happening?
Yeah, more conflict resolution options at school, perhaps. But again, if we can restrict those, just like us, right? Like, how many times do you find, and maybe this isn't true for you and your wife, but how many times do I find myself just texting my husband who's downstairs instead of going downstairs and talking face to face? It impacts us as adults. So you can imagine, as a child, without impulse control, without, you know, the history of having these phones for decades like us, it's too tempting just to text instead of going face to face. You don't learn those social skills.
The reason I text her when she's upstairs is because it's more polite than yelling.
Sure.
Instead I say, hi, little heart, you know.
Oh, yeah. You got to put emojis in there. Make sure you soften the blow. Yeah.
In the nation's northwest corner.
We head just a few miles east of Fife to the city of Sumner, where city leaders have been working for the past few years to renovate and restore the historic Ryan House, which dates back to the 1870s and the 1880s before Washington even became a state. Last week, however, those plans abruptly changed, and the Ryan House could be demolished as soon as this November. So historian Felix Minnell went all lights and sirens on that to try to save it.
Now, we haven't gotten quite that far. Give me a few days to get warmed up for this story. Now,
okay.
I saw a flurry of activity on social media over the weekend, and then some people in Sumner reached out to me because they were upset to learn that last week the city council there voted to demolish the Ryan House. I admit, I've never heard of the Ryan House before. It's a Victorian home on Main Street in Sumner. It was bequeathed to the city by its owner, Lucy Ryan, back in the 20s. It served as a library for decades, and more recently was home to the Sumner Historical Society. And as you said, it dates to territorial days before Washington was a state. There's not many homes, period, that date back that far. Now, a few years ago, the city of Sumner set out to raise money to restore and renovate the Ryan House. They were very successful. They lined up hundreds of thousands of dollars of money from the Pierce County Hotel Motel Tax, from the state of Washington's Heritage Capital Program. And the work had gotten underway in earnest earlier this year. I talked to Carmen Palmer. She's communications director for the city of Sumner. She said the project was full speed ahead this spring. But as the engineers were doing an assessment and started removing the walls, they found the Ryan House is actually missing all these beams and other important structural elements that weren't necessarily required back in the territorial days. Huh. Now makes it much more expensive to save than first thought, and it means the building is likely to collapse in on itself if they're not careful. So the city council voted last week to essentially red tag the building. Now it has to come down. That work could begin as soon as November. The decision's taken a lot, made people upset and kind of taken everyone by surprise. Now, the structural issues were first discovered back in May. They were discussed in committee meetings that were open to the public back then, but most people only became aware of the problem last week when they heard that it's going to be demolished. Now, Carmen Palmer with the city of Sumner, when I talked to her yesterday morning, she seemed a little frustrated that only now are Sumner people saying how much they care about the Ryan House.
We have put it in multiple newsletters. We've put it out there. Project Page has been up since 2019. Where was all this effort to save it then? No one called me. No one called and offered assistance, funding. Hey, I love this house. So where was all of this when we were working to save it? And I really wish we had seen this groundswell then. It was, as you said, in the media, but nothing.
Well, what's been in the media in the last couple of years is how successful they've been in raising money and all the work they're going to do. So there's been nothing now until now about the potential problems. It just so happens the city of Sumner is holding one of its occasional public open houses tonight at City Hall from 5 p.m. to 7 p.m. Carmen Palmer expects that a lot of people who care about the Ryan House will be there to voice their concerns and give the city an earful. Now, I asked, is it too late for a group of citizens to organize themselves in order to line up more support? They're about $1 million short, maybe, and get the larger community to step up, kind of like what happened over in Parkland with the old Parkland School.
They would have to come not just with ideas. They'd have to come with a check.
Yeah.
But I think if there's someone, you know, listening to your report, who read the thing, who is sitting on an extra, you know, $2 million, please let us know right away.
So there still is time, and this meeting is tonight, 5 to 7 p.m. at Council Chambers at the Sumner City Hall at 1104 Maple Street. I'm going to try and go there myself and kind of see what people are saying, because it seems like, again, if the citizens want to do it, there's still time to do something. The house has been sitting there for more than 100 years. It's not going to fall down tomorrow.
Mm-hmm.
So it depends what people want.
Will you testify?
No. I'm a journalist, Dave. You know, it's all just objectivity for me.
Will you testify?
No, I'm not going to testify. Okay. I'm just there to gather and hear what's going on. Because I think my favorite thing is when communities organize themselves to do really cool, positive things. And if it involves saving something historic, well, even better.
If someone were to point to you and say, hey, you know, Felix Bonnell is here, would that be okay?
I'll be hiding in the back. I'll be in disguise.
Felix Bonnell. Thank you, Felix.
Oh, let's go.
Choke points. Those orange stripes on I-5 near 70th and Fife are going to be going away soon. Chris has the details.
Yeah, that orange striping was put up over the summer in about a mile stretch of I-5 through the Fife construction zone. Those stripes are going to be going away in the next couple of weeks as construction on the new bridges over the Hylabos Creek move into another phase.
We have this median work, which is building the new bridges for the relocated Hylabos under I-5. So we're building the inner halves of those bridges.
Washington Department of Transportation project engineer Tom Slimak says the contractor is getting close to finishing that first phase.
So coming up here around middle of October, we anticipate we will be shifting traffic back towards the median, and they'll be on those new bridges while we then establish a work zone on the outsides to build the remaining halves of those bridges.
So a major traffic shift is coming up, and drivers will need to move back toward the inside of the freeway. Slimak says the 50-mile-an-hour speed limit will also go away at the same time.
We won't have all lanes as a regulatory speed reduction once we shift back. We'll be doing it in advisory speed for these inside lanes as you're adjacent to that barrier to slow down, but it will not be all lanes a regulatory speed reduction.
The orange striping will disappear after that traffic shift. Now, Washington had several other states are testing this orange paint for the Federal Highway Administration. It wants to know if it makes work zones any safer. If the idea is that drivers will see another visual cue inside a work zone and help them slow down or be safer.
When we shift back to the median, we will remove those orange stripes at that point. And then we'll collect all that data that we've been over the last several months collecting from traffic operations and comments from the public to then see if we can draw any conclusions on the benefits of the orange striping.
All that data will be given to the feds, and they'll see if it worked. There are nearly 1,200 work zone accidents across Washington last year. 22% of those crashes were in Pierce County, where this work zone is located. Of course, Pierce County has a ton of construction as well. So what I'd like to know is if you, as the drivers, have changed your behavior in the work zone because of the orange striping, or if you think it's had any impact at all. You can use your voice to text or hit us up when you get where you're going. State Roofing text line 888-973-5476. Was this a good idea, bad idea, whatever. What do you think?
I liked it when I drove through it. And I don't get to Pierce County that often, honestly. But when I was down there, and I think I had mentioned to you when I got back to work, it did give me pause and definitely slowed me down.
Well, that's
it was
good.
A good reminder, because I think you can get tunnel vision when you're driving and you go, oh, shoot, I'm in a construction zone now. But this kind of gives you that extra warning if you do have tunnel vision, because it's right in front of your face on the road. So
yeah.
I think anything to keep the construction sites and people safe is a good thing.
Well, good. Well, yeah, I'd be interested. Dave, did you ever get a chance to see him?
Yeah, I've seen him. I've seen him in other places, too. And that's great. My gripe is with the regular striping, which just isn't there in some places. I noticed that during my trip to Canada, what they're doing, because it's so tough to see the road sometimes, is to alternate on the usual white stripes, white and black, so that when you have the lighter concrete, you can still see where the lanes are.
Oh, really? But interesting.
But there's still places on the roads. Now that the rain is back, there are places where the lane's going to be invisible. I mean, I'm still harping on Edgar Martinez way there as you're going up that ramp to the beginning of I-90, but mm-hmm. there's just no stripes at all there now. And it's a merge, and so you don't know who's supposed to yield and who's not.
Yeah, and especially with all the construction where we've had lane shifts and things. We were driving through the rain coming home from the airport, and we went through one of those spots where there was a lane jog and it's not there anymore.
Yeah.
But the old ground off old paint from the lane shift is still kind of there, and you can see you're like, okay, there's white there. Now I'm driving in the middle of a yeah. what used to be the shift, and especially when it rains, they can kind of get they become ghost lines, and it's kind of hard to know where you are. But yeah, it'd be interesting to see what people think. Novel idea, and in some places they did different things with the paint. We only painted the stripes. Other places did the fog lines. Others did other types of things to see if this works. So we'll see, because they might be popping up elsewhere if they seem to have any reduction at all.
We're going to speak more with New York Times writer Jessica Barrett. She published an interactive article titled Being 13, where she followed the lives of three teen girls in different parts of the country for an entire year to learn how phone use and social media affects their lives.
And their brain development, too. So I asked Jessica about something that impacts even adult women, including myself, comparison. If I'm aiming for the perfection based on fake filters and curated homes that I see, how are teen girls processing this, and how is it affecting their brain development?
Yeah, so there's a really longitudinal and in-depth study that's happening now that is looking and following teenagers, but over the course of a long period, to try to understand how social media and all these platforms really affects their brains. And there have been all sorts of studies looking at this, but a lot of them are inconclusive. Some of them contradict one another. So it's hard to know. But what we do know is that, like you said, the prefrontal cortex, which is the part of the brain associated with decision-making, impulse control, these sort of markers that you have to stop yourself from doing something, are not fully developed until you're like in your early 20s. So what happens when you're on these platforms then, and you're kind of searching for feedback, and you don't have the impulse control that you might, or that a person who's fully grown might. And then at the same time, your hormones are raging. For girls especially, estrogen is through the roof. It's like they're having these huge feelings. And I don't know that they're fully equipped or even conscious yet of being able to talk about them in a healthy way. So I think for parents, it's knowing these things. It's like understanding some of the nuance. It's not just like taking the phone away from your kid so that they can't interact at all. I think it's having really open conversations about what they are seeing and trying to get at, like you just said, Colleen, not everything you see is real. Like, there is so much misinformation now. Everything is sort of perfected and curated and airbrushed. And these are not real people's lives. And so trying to talk openly about that with these girls, and we did talk a lot about that. And like you said, I'd really encourage people to listen to the audio, which is them in their own words describing what it's like. Mm-hmm. But I find myself getting caught up in this too.
Yeah, right. And we are adult women. Our brains are supposed to be fully formed. And I'm just figuring out how my hormones work and how social media is affecting me. It really does frighten me. And that's not to use like a fear tactic or fear words for our listeners, but it does scare me when I see, even at 10 years old, how this is already impacting peers of my daughter, and going, even if we as adult women who grew up with social media and phones, even just for half of our life, need to take the reins and go, I don't know what I'm doing, but I know I'm going in the right direction for my daughter by not letting her on social media, not letting her interact with bullies online. And then you also had a story in your article about, you know, the 13-year-old girl who was talking with a 17-year-old over text message in a different state. Like, that's how trafficking and kidnapping begins. And she doesn't have the decision making or life experience to know talking with a 17-year-old who's out of state is not safe for me. It may feel good to her, but it's not safe.
It's really complicated. And you don't, you know, at the same time, so that girl that you mentioned, I was with her at school towards the end of the school year last year, and they had a lockdown. And, you know, this is just what it is for a lot of teenagers these days, but they had this lockdown, and her mother found out about the lockdown through a text message from the school. But meanwhile, she has her phone and they haven't told the students yet what is happening. So she's texting the daughter saying, okay, there is a lockdown, but everything's okay. And the daughter doesn't even know this information yet. And it is almost like, okay, you can see why parents want to be able to be in touch with their kids.
Absolutely.
You know, it's a safety mechanism too. And so a lot of what the school administrators have said is that when they've tried to really crack down on rules about phone use in class or not even bringing phones into the building, it's often the parents who push back. So it's complicated. There's no easy answer. And I think at the end of the day, it's like, people need to hold the social media companies accountable. Like, they are the ones that are serving all of this toxic material to teenagers of all kinds. But how do you do that? I'm not sure.
It sounds like, though, you're saying that over time, they come to realize that nothing that they see online can be entirely trusted, right? Because everybody's putting up this facade. So speaking as someone whose hormones stopped working long ago, I mean, that's the conclusion I finally came to. The more perfect someone seemed online, the more screwed up I figured they were. And don't teens eventually realize that, too?
But that's if the teens can survive it, right? Yeah. Like, damage done by the time they realize it. Like, that, to me, is the scary part. But
yeah, true.
So this article came out. There have been a lot of really amazing comments and people writing in and, you know, pediatricians and various experts. There's also a lot of nasty people online who are commenting because, of course, that's what people do online. I had very long discussions with these girls and the parents. Do not read the comments. Do not read the comments. I am a grown 40-something-year-old woman. I do not read the comments because it makes me feel bad. The girls are still reading the comments, you know? They know, and yet they're reading the comments and feeling bad about it. So it's just, it's really tricky.
Jessica Bennett from the New York Times. It's an excellent interactive piece about teenage girls and social media. Jessica, thank you.
Thanks for having me.
And even when you do restrict, like I said, in part one of the interview, we have a watch for my daughter now. A lot of restrictions on it. We can control it through an app, what games are on there, like tic-tac-toe, you know. But, and we can put it in school mode, so she can only text emergency contacts or call them through her watch while she's at school. That way it's not a distraction. But we were at the Washington State Fair this weekend with four of her peers. And I get that it's cool, it's new, it's technology. She was begging me, Mom, can you please turn on the games? Mom, can you please turn on the games? And I'm going, you're at the Washington State Fair with four of your friends. No, I don't care if you just want to show them how the games work. No, figure out how to interact with your peers without looking at technology. Yeah. And maybe that seems strict.
And what were her friends doing?
To kids these days? Oh, you know, they figured it out. None of them had phones or any sort of electronic devices. We had the watch on in case she got lost and needed to find me.
Sure.
But yeah, the draw, the pull of using technology, even when you're in this fun land, the Washington State Fair with four of your best friends, it's still there. And so again, it may seem little turning on games, but it's that. And then it's allowing the games in the car.
Yeah.
And then it's like, you know, so is it, you.
At what age did you first allow her to be alone with her phone?
Well, it's not a phone. It's a watch. And we just got it this summer. So she's 10 years old. A lot of her peers in fourth grade were getting those watches. Again, as parents say, it's a safety thing. You want to be able to reach them at school if there's an emergency.
Right.
But it starts trickling into life. And yeah, reading the science about brain development, that reward system, that dopamine you get from playing a game on your phone, we get it as adults.
And so what are the rules in grade school these days on phones?
I think it's like no phone use. I think a lot of teachers
they don't confiscate them or anything.
As long as you're not caught using it during class, they don't confiscate them. But certainly if you are caught, then it's like, nope, give me the phone.
So you can't text answers to each other during exams?
Yeah, that would be tricky. Yeah, no, she can only text us during school hours. Your daily dose of kindness now brought to you by Robert W. Baird. A restaurant popular with foodies is sharing the message, kindness always wins. Katrina Markle with CBS affiliate KMTV has the story.
Sauced by Alfaro is a popular restaurant here in downtown Papillion. But last Friday, someone stole money from their tip jar. And owner Michelle Alfaro responded, and she responded in a way that you might not expect.
It was important for me to make the post because it was just kind of eating at me.
She wrote about the theft on social media.
It's coming from a place of frustration, anger, sadness, all of those things. And I would write the post and I would delete it, write it and delete it. And I just knew that God wanted me to do something different.
So instead...
So I literally sat my phone down, prayed, and asked how he wanted me to handle it. And it was quick, responsive, with kindness.
She wrote, "We don't know what you're going through, but I pray it gets better." Chef Alfaro also shared a graphic with the message, "Kindness always wins." She hoped her social media post might reach the person who stole the money.
It reminded me, we never know what someone's going through. And if they have to seek in something such an act of desperation, what was challenging them? What were they going through?
What she reached was people's hearts. Donation after donation, people pleading for her Venmo account.
But they were so adamant about helping us and our team and making someone else's wrong right.
Donations many, many times greater than the cash lost in the tip jar. It didn't stop there. They're being gifted security cameras and a sealed tip jar.
And it helped our entire team. So it wasn't just the people that worked that night. These people blessed our entire team. And that's awesome.
Chef Alfaro says it can be hard to receive kindness from others, but...
It's just a really beautiful thing. Like, I think every person on our team experienced some form of emotion when they saw the community come together.
In Papillion, Katrina Markle, 3 News Now.
7:49, Seattle's Morning News. The subject is crying babies on a crowded airplane. Babies that won't stop crying. Babies that won't listen to the instructions about seatbelts or ambling about the cabin. And Ursula Reutin is here to add her perspective to this. So have you been imprisoned on a flight with crying babies?
Well, Dave, nothing like tainting the jury before we even get started here. Yes, not only have I been surrounded by babies, I've also brought my own babies onto planes.
Well, shame on you.
And oh, my gosh. Wait, you were never a baby?
Yes, I was.
Okay.
And I brought babies on flights.
Thank you. Exactly. Okay. That all said, I don't get all worked up about babies, but there are people who do. And if you want to pay extra, it's not like they're banning. Cause if you look at the headline, it says, "Should babies be banned?" Mm-hmm. That doesn't mean that every baby. There is a European airline.
A European airline.
Yes.
I see. Okay.
So it's come up. But it's come up in the past, too. We even asked on the show yesterday, on the Gene Ursula show yesterday, should they be, you know, banned from first class? Again, if you're willing to pay the amount to sit in first class, I say you can bring whatever that you want.
Yeah, I brought a baby on first class before. I think June was 2 months old, and I had to go down to Salt Lake for a work thing. And I thought, there's no way, if I'm going to fly postpartum with a two-month-old baby, there's no way I'm sitting in any other seat. And plus, to Salt Lake, it was like 30 extra bucks to sit in first class. But I did everything I could to make sure that June didn't cry, you know, like put her on the breast right away
exactly.
When you're taking off, so there's no problem there. Like, I did everything. And she cried for maybe 20 seconds, and then it was over. I definitely could feel the glances, like, oh, is this going to be a while? But again, yeah, if you can pay the price, you get to fly how you want to fly. There's nothing against the rules. So
exactly. Yeah. So here's my question for you, Dave. Mm-hmm. Would you rather have a drooling drunk dude sitting next to you?
Yeah.
Or a baby who might cry
easy
on
answer.
Occasion?
Having brought babies and, you know, raised a couple and a couple of grandchildren, I no longer mind babies crying. Yeah. I understand the parents are not doing it on purpose. Like, babies not doing it on purpose. That's what kids do. And a plane is an upsetting environment for some kids. And I just say, yep, I've been through this and I have sympathy for the parents. I'm not going to create a fuss about it.
Well, the other thing is, if you're going to be on a short flight, it's really manageable.
Right. Yeah.
Now, when you're on one of those intercontinental flights.
Well, if
or
you're 12 hours to New Zealand, hours,
yeah, I might consider, you know, but again,
but no baby's going to cry for all 12
hours. Exactly. And if parents are prepared and people are patient, I think both can coexist.
Plus, we have noise-canceling headphones.
Exactly.
Put your headphones on and watch Curb Your Enthusiasm. That got me through the six-hour flight from Montreal.
It's
back.
A tube.
It is a tube.
It doesn't matter. It's like having a smoking section on an airplane. Yeah. A lot of good that did.
Oh,
for the non. Yeah, I mean, it's like,
wait, are you speaking up for the anti-baby crowd?
No, I'm just saying, it's like, why would you pay extra? Because the noise is going to get to you anyway, even if they're in
gotcha.
The far back. I mean, having a segregated section for babies or whatever, you're still going
it.
To hear it. I mean,
the baby cabin.
I mean, yeah, I don't know. It just was going to be like the crying room at church. You know, just lock them off in the back. I don't know.
Now, it is a little bit different if you've got them right next to you.
That, well, true, but still.
So, in that case, though, that's when I like overcompensate because I know how hard it is to be in an uncomfortable situation. You can't get your kid to stop crying or your whatever. And so then I heap on the, you know, kindness. And can I help you? I'm starting to pull things, anything, like an earplug out. You know, a kid can be amused by anything. I start to try to help because that's what I wished for when I had a baby crying. So, I would much what's a bigger problem, a crying baby or a drunk person?
Exactly.
I feel like there's way too many sloppy drunk people on airplanes.
Agree.
And nobody's saying ban alcohol, but somehow we're saying ban babies, like entire human beings. It's just, to me, these debates are so irritating.
Sometimes the drunks cry too.
Exactly, right? Yeah, and then throw up. Just
and,
like babies.
Again, if you really want to pay that extra money and you want to be, you know, sequestered in the front, fine.
Rent a private jet then.
There you go.
Great solution.
We all agreed
something
on this.
Available to all.
Rent a private
this is
jet.
Beautiful. Harmony.
Yes.
Gianna Ursula, 9 o'clock on Cairo News Radio. Thanks for listening to Seattle's Morning News. I'm Dave Ross.
And I'm Colleen O'Brien. Thanks for listening to the show's podcast. We're happy you're here.
And you can keep up with the show and find some of the stories from today online at MyNorthWest.com.